Polymikonos, the versatile teacher of how not to be helpless. None of Odysseus's frequently occurring epithets is as sonorous and full of prescient undertones as the word polymikonos. It brings to mind the connection, already evident to the Greeks, between cunning, guile, and contrivance, maschina. If, in the parlance of our times, we speak of machines, maschinen, a term that can be traced back to the Latin machina, the equivalent of the Greek mechane, we ordinarily do not still have this term's basic meaning in mind. Originally, a mechane, or machina, is just a ruse, a subterfuge, a trick, hitting an opponent below the belt. Its quote-unquote setting in life, as biblical philologists put it, is initially only to be found in the way that human beings deal with rivals and adversaries who are considered to have violated the rules of the game. Only with the concept's extension to complex instruments do we arrive at a machine from what was originally a ruse. This extension occurs with good reason insofar as we are ready to define machines as devices for the circumvention of nature, whose assistance allows human activity to sidestep a problem that cannot be directly resolved in order to handle it indirectly. As is well known, the lever is the paradigm for every cunning mechanical effect in antiquity. With levers, human beings are able to transport loads that would otherwise be impossible to move. In ancient times, levers were often used to operate a theatre crane, which allowed tragic poets to have the gods float down into a scene from above, something still familiar to us today as Deus Ex Machina, the first special effect which can be traced back to this technological device. A while later, we find something comparable in the church father Ignatius of Antioch, when he declares, in his letter to the Ephesians about 100 years after Christ, that the cross, stauros, is a mechane of Christ, an expression that has to be translated as rope attached to a hoisting crane. This device's usefulness in constructing the realm of God must be acknowledged, which is precisely what Ignatius means when he says that such machines of Christ first make it possible to erect a temple for the Father's glorification. In contrast, until the 18th century, every use of the word machina was subjectively characterized by strategic orientation. Indeed, sheer cunning in making a move was so present in the term's usage that one can only decide on a case-by-case basis whether a given discourse is concerned with a ruse or with a machine. In Lorenzo de Ponte's libretto, The Marriage of Figaro, from 1786, we find the semantically and musically crucial passage, Tutte le machine rovestiero, translated as All Your Plots I'll Overthrow, in the aria Se vuol ballare, Signor Contino, and it is here evident that the word machina here does not mean machines, but rather machinations, by means of which the Count would like to enforce his feudal privilege with the lady, the lovely Susanna, the very woman with whom Figaro is head over heels in love. If Homer frequently describes his hero as polymechanos, it is not enough to translate the word as cunning, resourceful, deviser of intrigues and so forth, as though we were simply confronted with a sly character's incidental features. We must bear in mind that the machine's triumphal procession through the human sphere had already begun in Homer's time. Polymechanos is thus not merely an attribute that adorns a single clever hero. At a basic level, it can already be used to broadly characterize the civilizing work environment of that era, including metallurgy, navigation, urban planning, and epic poetry. Because war has always involved the polytechnical education of engineers, it is no wonder that the epithet polymechanos is initially attributed to a warrior. It has often been noted that Odysseus represents a new type of hero who, very much in distinction from the purely thymotic and violently raging type exemplified by Achilles, can be described as a cognitive hero, proficient in delay. The defining feature of the character Odysseus is not merely a more advanced operation of reflective qualities, but more importantly, his quite pronounced manipulative attitude towards human beings and things from a strategic perspective. This shift of perspective already defines the conclusion of the Iliad. It is well known that Achilles' wild raging power does not decide the Trojan War, but rather Odysseus's war machine, the sinister, hollow horse in whose belly some of the best Greek warriors are hiding. And incidentally, we should note that we have traditionally been provided with more names of passengers than there were spots available in the horse's interior. With the apparent retreat of the Greek fleet from the Trojan shore, the strategic aspect of this mechany is emphasised, namely that it makes the gift seem plausible. The horse machine not only outwits the Trojans, at the same time it plays the gods off against each other, since while it is an apparent offering to Poseidon, who was favourably disposed towards the Trojans, it was really intended as a tribute to Athena, who was favourably disposed towards the Greeks. Yet the cunning polymechanical Odysseus does not celebrate its greatest intellectual historical triumph in Troy, but on the high seas, when he constructs the first machine of self-inhibition, while his ship subtly sails past the treacherous rocks on which the Sirens perched, which has since become legendary in the European tradition. The technical simplicity of the hero's fettering should not deceive us. Even here we have a genuine case of mechanical engineering. Odysseus constructs a dispositif by building a functional ad hoc wax rope mast machine. Stoics were already able to easily expand on this image by interpreting the fettered sailor as the prototype of the sage who traverses the temptations of the world bound to the mast of exercise and reflection. The mast symbolizes the fundamental Stoic distinction between the things that are up to us. These, of course, are our own thoughts, feelings, and judgments, and the things that are not up to us, in other words, the colossal remainder, which with explicit disparagement is referred to as the external world, or a diaphora. Only someone tied to his or her own mast has the chance for a happy life, insofar as such a person will be happy in a philosophical sense, by keeping to what falls within their own sphere of power, a life that has found refuge from temptation. The analogies between the mast and the cross obviously did not escape the early Christians. Maximus of Tyre is the clearest example of this when in the first half of the 5th century he writes that Christ, quote, was bound to the cross so that we can be drawn through the tempting dangers of the world as though with closed ears, end quote. The Christian community is here interpreted as a group of hetairoi who row through the world under the command of their crucified captain with the wax of the gospel in their ears. Over the last 2 millennia, countless authors have assimilated the episode of the Sirens into their own respective frameworks, drawing on this kind of unscrupulous reinterpretation. Not too long ago, the unorthodox Marxist Theodor Adorno showed us where such reinterpretation can lead. He seriously thought that we could recognize Odysseus as the first citizen, who, bound to the mast of delayed gratification, misses out on what he desires, yet does so in a conscious and culturally enlightened way, while the rowers represent the unconscious proletariat who have the wax of mass culture in their ears and never experience what he is able to avoid. Had Adorno not speculated from memory, but consulted the original, he might have noted that the Sirens are not prostitutes who offer their charms for free and feign erotic socialism, nor are they singers in a Wagnerian opera who glorify the love of death. Their lethal charm is based on their ability to charm the hero sailing by into believing that he is experiencing his apotheosis, so that he feels transported from their mouths to the realm of myths and gods. This divinization, while alive, is what drives men out of their minds, leading them to jump overboard only to perish at the foot of the transfiguring rocks. Barton Brock has more likely adopted the right approach, when he would like to recognise Odysseus as the father of artists of self-captivation, or in other words, of the rare species of artists, at least at this point, who are ready to shield the contemporary social world, Mittwelt, from its own delusions of grandeur and from its fury for self-actualization. On this reading, we find ourselves back in Stoic territory, since Stoics not only learn to be on their guard against external distractions, but are also cautious when it comes to the ambivalent tendencies of their own internal states. The Sirens would thus be accomplices of the megalomaniacal dispositions that are so easy to arouse in the souls of warriors and artists, and that today provide the cues for the art market and celebrity complex. That Odysseus resists the Sirens' temptation should ultimately not surprise us. Indeed, we might even ask whether he would have made it past them without rope and mast, since he had already refused private immortality at Calypso's side. But since the Sirens' overtures concern great or popular immortality, it was perhaps sensible to avail himself of rope in case of such temptation. Nevertheless, I do not think that the Stoic appropriation of the figure of Odysseus should have the last word here. If we take the epithet polymechanos seriously, it once again leads us to the sophistic movement, which had a much higher potential for genuinely philosophical content than might have been apparent after Plato's lethal denunciations. We can see that the sophistic movement had an indispensable and unparalleled spiritual and philosophical significance, as soon as we acknowledge its fundamental ethical figure. It puts all of its best energy into a single gesture, supporting the revolt of human beings against helplessness, which has proven to be an essential element of the adventure of European civilization. Helplessness had a name among the Greeks, amechania, which literally means the complete absence of cunning, guile, and contrivance, the lack of an art or wits that would show a way out, to be without the resources that could help those in need avert what is availing them. It is the condition human beings descend into when the spirit of mechany, or polymechanos attitude, is dormant. They then sink into a stupor, or become resigned to their lack of resources, falling into a kind of contented misfortune. They succumb to dejection when faced with the challenge of finding ways out and ways around adversity to something better. Thus, if we are unwilling to translate amechania as helplessness, we could perhaps instead render it as quote-unquote oblivious to resources, or quote-unquote refusing to see that there is a way out. Phrases that horrifyingly sum up what most of humanity has actually accomplished throughout history. Among the Greeks, as we know, divinity easily emerges from a general concept, and thus they recognize a goddess, or daemon, by the name of amechania, helplessness, the daughter of Penia, ragged poverty. The latter, as we may recall, is the goddess of not having, who is depicted in Plato's Symposium as the mother of the demigod Eros, that forceful rogue who guides human beings towards what they are lacking. Both daimones, helplessness and poverty, played a role in a famous diplomatic dispute that is recounted by Herodotus. When Themistocles wanted to impose a tribute on the Andrians, with the argument that Athens had two powerful and obliging gods on its side, persuasion, patho, and necessity, anagkê, the Andrians are supposed to have replied that this alliance might well explain Athens' good fortune, but in contrast, they were the homeland of two less obliging goddesses, Penia and amechania. Quote, "The Andrians, being possessed of these deities, would not give money, for never could the power of the Athenians get the better of their inability." End quote. Today it would appear that the Andrians have the upper hand nearly everywhere. Incidentally, it is a testament to Sigmund Freud's classical education when, shortly before the publication of The Interpretation of Dreams, he remarks in a letter to Wilhelm Fliess, from September 1899, quote, "I have made the acquaintance of helpless poverty and am constantly in fear of her, End quote. He is thus quite aware of how Pena and A. Mecania go hand in hand, and moreover knows that speaking, and being allowed to speak, can help us against both of them. To be sure, money earned by the psychoanalytic sophistic is still greater help to him, and not for nothing does Freud say in the same passage, quote-unquote, money is my laughing gas, since where money flows, helplessness has lost the game. In making these observations, we touch on the dynamic of Greek cultural life and approach everything of concern to Europe via a detour through Greece. If we find the struggle between ability and inability at the basis of our culture, and ultimately a basis of all other cultures, then philosophy should take a stance in this primal dispute. As long as philosophy is well disposed to knowledgeable and proficient ability, it reveals itself to be partisan. It only comes into its own when it sets to work to expand the initially still small island of ability out into the ocean of inability. However, as soon as philosophy separates knowledge from ability, only to pursue impotent theory, it is eaten away by ressentiment, precisely as happened in the theoretical tendencies of later Platonism, with its grudge against rivals who could also address themselves to the masses, and which is also prominent in more than one present-day school of philosophy, when we find polemics against authors who are attempting a philosophical conception of the world in terms their contemporaries can actually understand. To advocate the vital unity of knowledge and ability was the sophistic movement's sole historic mission, insofar as it represented the first educational system and first training ground for capability in general. Yet, since Greeks of the classical era considered being able to speak well to be the most dazzling of all abilities, the sophists put great stock in the rhetorical training of human beings so as to equip the latter with the necessary quick-wittedness for any situation in life. Seen in this light, the sophistic movement is something like a shipping company that wishes to make human beings seaworthy for the broadest sense of the term. It thus has the right word for every storm and an impressive conclusion any time there is a foundering. True sophists are utterly convinced that succumbing to a mechania is never advisable for human beings. The living being that has speech never seems entirely at a loss, is never entirely inept, without any counsel, and lacking in techniques that can provide a way out. And because the sophistic movement unprecedentedly and unforgettably validates the fundamental human claim of not being helpless, Polymechanos Odysseus is on board every enterprise that involves this clever praxis. Athena once said of this pre-Socratic from Ithaca that he was the cleverest of all men. The Oracle of Delphi later says the same thing of Socrates, so that the seafarer and the sophist are thus subtly associated with each other. From the perspective, and despite Plato's objections, the sophistic movement is the better philosophy, both before and after Socrates, because it much better supports the human emergence from self-imposed helplessness than does the exclusively obstinate and perpetually offended academy. Helplessness, which may initially be blameless, is self-incurred from the moment when the poor and less able for some reason refuse to learn what is necessary from those who are more capable and wealthier, so that they could become their rivals. Who could deny that this temptation today puts half of humanity on a slippery slope? If nothing else, Europeans, who are about to be transformed into a nation of lotus eaters, are in peril as they willingly break with their own tradition. Anyone who wishes to offer a new explanation of Europe to languishing Europeans, who would like to motivate them to return to their former glory, should again open ancient books. The European testaments to necessary sailing, travel stress, tests, crosses, cranes, masts, and contrivances for clever living. The great homecoming hero remains an indispensable, paradigmatic, absolutely exhilarating ally, the versatile teacher of how not to be helpless. Polymechanos, Polytropos, Polymetus, Telasiphronos, Polyphronos, Politlas Dios Odysseus.